back to you, Dick, WS-Twin.
No, I mean just this. When you got your TV from Cablevision or from Comcast, Time Warner, they got a limited amount of bandwidth, so what you get over the air is everything you can get, and what you get over the cable is not quite nearly the same.
Yeah, I record over the air. You know, if it's on PBS, I don't even bother with the Cablevision.
Are they transmitting a smaller number of audio bits and a smaller number of video bits? Is that why the resolution of both audio and video over a cable might be a little bit lower, Eric?
You need to take lessons from your son, you know? You gotta get out of this analog frame of mind. It ain't number of bits in the traditional sense, okay? What they do, look, use some simple math here, alright? What comes out of the camera before anything happens to it is 1.16 gigabits per second is a serial frame. It's three packets of 8 bits wide, or 10 bits wide, whereas let's call it 10 bits each. One of them, those packets, is 10 bits of luminance, one is 10 bits of R-minus wide, the other one, 10 bits of B-minus wide. That's where you have that, but let's use that for... We're now going to squeeze that down to maybe 18 megabits if we're lucky. It's a big reduction, so we've got to do some stuff to it. We've got to do magic of math and a little calculus in order to squeeze it down into that and make a serial stream out of it. When you look at CBS, they're no longer sending 18 megabits. They're sending like 17 and change because they have another channel now. But that 19 megabit stream total is not what the cable people want to send. They want to send maybe 14, maybe 13. They think they have an advantage because they're taking the MPEG-2 and turning it into MPEG-4, which then kind of messes it up even more, and they squish it down. When they squish it down, not only are they squishing the picture, but they're also squishing the audio a little bit.
If I did a sliding audio sine wave test on over-the-air audio broadcast...
You don't want to do that.
And if I did the same test... Maybe I do want to do that. If I did the same test with my cable, and I now plot frequency response as an XY plot of over-the-air audio versus cable realized audio, what differences would I see with those two plots, Eric? Go ahead.
That's really a test that's not going to help you, because if you're just going to do, say, you're measuring if you're doing a sweep and you're measuring the peak envelope of the sweep as it goes across, you're going to get the same thing both ways. But if you were to take that audio, let's say let's break it up into 10 kilohertz sine wave, right? Or 10 kilohertz square wave, which is more fun because you look on a spectrum analyzer. On the AC3 audio that you're starting with, that's running at 384 kilobits, you know, 5.1, you're going to see some funny stuff naturally because of the way 5.1 is, especially if you're running a single note, and then you do some broadband stuff, you see little slots in there of stuff that's missing, that you don't realize it's missing. But when you look at that 10 kilohertz sine wave on the cable, you're going to see the output filter having a harder time making those sine waves because the sample periods are a bit longer.
There are some cell phone companies that use various kinds of vocoder encrypting, de-encrypting, encoding, de-encoding, and whatever. In other words, somebody has written some algorithms to try to simulate, emulate, the individual sounds coming out of a human speech generating device called human being. And the way it gets reconstructed saves them a lot of bits, but there are times when you may not recognize the voice of your grandmother or your mother.
Welcome to DMR.
I hear you. I'd like to believe the vocoder type compression is not being used by broadcast or cable. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely, positively, without a doubt. They would die at quick death if they tried to do that kind of phonem generated. There's a number of different flavors of that. Actually, some of it has gotten a lot better, but no, what what Dolby does is they do similar to what they do in the front end of the noise reduction system, is to voice the audio up into different bands of frequency. And then they actually do matrix encoding between the various different bands, and so you're essentially taking three bands of stream and turning it into one, occupying the same space and time. And the other thing that they do is they do a very intelligent series of algorithms, which is called psychoacoustical compression. It actually analyzes the incoming audio and says that I have a model of the ear's dynamic range and its sensitivity. If a sound doesn't fall within the parameters of what you can hear, I ain't transmitting it. And because I ain't transmitting it, I ain't using it as much bits. Got the idea?
Yeah, but if the human hearing can't hear it, there's a very relativistic problem there. When I was 22 years of age fixing television sets, every house I walked into, I could tell you exactly how many televisions were operating. I could tell you which rooms they were in because I was hearing the 15750 coming out of the horizontal sweep circuit. As I've aged, all of that has disappeared. So at one period in time.
We're talking frequency. We're talking dynamic range things here. Let me give you an example. You're listening to Beethoven stuff. The kettle drums are going off. There's a little triangle going ding, ding, ding in the background. And Dolby said, you ain't never going to hear that. I ain't sending it.
Okay. Instantaneous dynamic range. I know that my frequency response has degraded, as it does with most people as they age. Has my dynamic range of hearing changed as I age? What's your guess on that one, Eric?
Yes, actually, it does change. It depends. What depends upon where your hearing loss comes from. The nerve endings, the little cilia that's in the cochlea, tends to maintain some of its sensitivity, even as the high end, which is really wrapped up in that long cochlea there, begin to degenerate and not actually respond. The nerve endings don't die off, but they stop sending impulses out, so to speak. The cilia that's left, especially down at the low end, through life you lose sensitivity, especially if you've been exposed to high levels of sound pressure, which actually compression is the little nerve fibers, and just like anything else, they wear out. But if you've protected your hearing for your life, even though you may be losing some of your high end, your ability, your sensitivity to hearing and the range at which you can hear pretty much stays the same, but it does diminish a little bit.
In my youth, I was quite interested in model airplanes, and quite a few of those engines, high-speed engines, I'd be testing in my basement as a teenager, and some of those noises echoed in my basement were extremely loud. Guaranteed I was giving some grief to my hearing that didn't show up right away, but showed up later. From your experience, Eric, are there people who are smart enough to protect their hearing throughout their life, and did they approach, let me pick a number, 55 years of age, still having a high-frequency hearing with good sensitivity? Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Believe it or not, there's a really strange group of people who became very hearing conscious very early on. And you'll find that there's a group of rock musicians that are literally deaf, and there's later rock musicians that hear as well as they ever did because they protected themselves.
Yeah, you're giving me the answer. Most likely I did it. I wasn't smart enough to wear hearing protection as a teenager. Back in the 50s and the 60s, it probably didn't exist. If a person went into the equivalent of Harbor Freight and asked for earmuffs for hearing protection or earplugs in the year, let's say, 1955, I'm not sure it existed. What do you think, Eric? Or it probably existed in very narrow fields of endeavor. Over to you.
The consciousness of hearing protection, the way we know it today, didn't begin until like the 50s, the mid-50s. Actually, I'm a victim of it, because of some of the drugs and some of the diseases that were out there, caused an awful lot of people have severe hearing loss, and as they began to investigate the causes, one of the things that they saw over time with people who were exposed to last known. If you look at the artists of today that play on large venue stages, you'll notice that they all have, in both ears, they have monitor devices. Not only do these monitor devices actually act as sound attenuators, plus it gives them their mix so that they have something to follow. Most of the modern ones have noise canceling on them, meaning that any of the external sounds are electronically canceled to minimize the pressure within the ear canal. And actually, when you turn the audio feeding them down to zero, it's like being in a silent room, even though you've got 120 dB of sound pressure all around you.
Yeah, that sounds pretty nice. The cochlea of the hearing system of a human being looks sort of like a seashell, of the high-frequency notes being received by the narrow channel way downrange in the tight center turn. Is that where the high-frequency noise, the high-frequency sounds are being interpreted? And if you expose yourself to a lot of high-amplitude noise, are those the detectors that get damaged? And even though you don't see the effect immediately, later in life, the damage starts showing up. Is that approximately what happens, Eric? Because I think people who have heard loud sounds at an early age tend to lose the high-frequency notes sooner. Over to you, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2J. Well, you know, with conventional thinking, you would think that in terms of wavelength, that the low frequencies would be the long, at the end of the long thing, but it's actually the reverse. The tightly wound cilia and the length of the cilia is actually smaller. The length is shorter, resonating through. But they resonate with the sound pressure moving. Don't forget, this is all in an aqueous solution. It's a liquid that's transferring from the oval window and passes that sound information throughout the entire body of the cochlea. So, if you think of it in terms of the pressure gradient within inside of it, the highest pressures are all the way at the very end where it stops.
That's a little bit like what happens with a wave in the ocean. As it approaches the shore, where the shore ground level is coming up and the water is being squeezed into a more vertically narrow channel, that's where you get the wave breaking. I think you're telling me there's a somewhat similar phenomenon going on inside the cochlea. Go ahead.
You can think of it like that. That's a pretty good association of what's going on in there. The finest cilia is subject to damage more rapidly than those little pieces of cilia that are longer and thicker that react to the low frequency. So, you can do more damage up there than you can. That's why you lose the high end of your hearing as opposed to the low end of your hearing. There are other things that are involved in hearing between the eardrum, the stirrup and the anvil, the bones that actually connect to the oval window. There are people that get calcifications and other biochemical issues that actually restrict the ability to transfer vibration from the eardrum to the oval window of the cochlea, which, by the way, is a very, very fine membrane. Interestingly enough, you'll see people like Les Limbaugh, who lost his hearing for whatever reasons. He's got a cochlear implant. Resolution of what they're able to provide, because you have to take that nerve bundle, divvy it up, and break those signals up into a matrix that actually we don't have the perfect formula for yet. Think of it as a three-dimensional array of how you feed signals into that nerve bundle, because you actually separate each individual bundle and tie it to a driver, which is basically to transmit those signals into the nerve bundle. It probably takes a couple of weeks to do that for the doctor to separate each one of those nerve fibers under the microscope. That's not so easy. So the technology that we have today takes a person that's totally deaf and gives them the ability to hear. And by the way, you can actually do it at the base of the brainstem as opposed to at the ear, at the point of where the nerve ending is to the
repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
What's unique about the human hearing system is it's like a spectrum analyzer, but it's a ubiquitous spectrum analyzer. In other words, it's able to hear all tones simultaneously compare the relative amplitudes and phases and whatever. An ordinary spectrum analyzer cannot do that. When it comes to high-frequency note reception inside the cochlea, is the cochlea plus brain recognizing a particular standing wave pattern and it says, aha, that's a 10 kilohertz note, or is there a particular location in the cochlea where the 10 kilohertz note is being received? Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Well, if you were to take a survey of, say, maybe 10 years ago of recording engineers, and you actually map out their hearing, you'll find that some of the hearing, there's one guy that I know has done some really big records that had a huge hole between 1 and 2 kilohertz. It is actually location-based within the cochlea. Cilia resonate to a specific frequency or a specific area of frequency. And there's more than like a million cells in there, so, you know, go figure. You have that resolution. You have people who can hear a note and say, ah, that's an A440. And you got people who can tell you, ah, that's an A440, but it's 6 cents off. So resolution and frequency in the human being is actually amazing. It gets worse as you get higher because there's actually less, because they have to cover more frequency. And you'll find that you get towards the end that those bits of cilia respond to more than just one frequency.
The cochlea has got a seashell-like shape to it, and there is a tightly spiraled end to it. That portion of the cochlea is emphasizing what in the frequency domain compared to the wider beginning portion of it. I mean, what part of the cochlea is doing what, and why is there a tightly wound end section, Eric? As you can tell, I'm not quite sure what all is going on here. K2LAW.
Well, you can thank nature for that. You've got where the oval window is and where the entrance is. That's the low-frequency domain. That's where the cilia is the longest, the thickest, and actually the density is quite dense. You get a lot of resolution. So hearing from, say, 40 hertz to 300 hertz, you can tell the difference between a tenth of a hertz of change, or even less in some people. As you get higher in frequency, you're going further down into that spiral part, actually the whole thing is a spiral part, of the cochlea. Right? At one point, I think it's around 1.2 or 1.6 kilohertz, I forget what the number is. That's where the curve really begins, and it spirals up. Nature made the spiral for several reasons, one being you only got so much space in your head. So you've got to contain this stuff, which is going to wind up in this huge bundle of nerves that transmit this information to the brain within a limited amount of space. The second thing that I think nature, and I'm not quite sure about this, I actually need to go reread if I'm going to talk about it, there's a dampening effect that occurs. The fact that it's coiled like that, the actual size of the tissue that holds it, and let's call it, for the sake of it, let's say it was like an artery that rolled up, the diameter gets smaller and smaller as you get towards the end, which you can kind of relate to. You're going higher and higher in frequency, the wavelength is getting shorter and shorter. K2RAW, K2GX.
So all the very fine cilia, the shorter ones that are looking for the high frequency notes, I'm guessing they're somewhat concentrated toward the narrow, tightly coiled portion, and the high-frequency notes, the short cilia, there's not as many of them near the beginning before the curve. Is that roughly true, Eric?
Yes. By the way, there's glands there that secrete the fluid to maintain the pressure inside there. And there's something very special about the end of the way the cochlea is wrapped up that has to do with absorbing, preventing standing waves. Again, I need to reread that to refresh my mind in terms of what the actual dynamics is of what's going on there. But as you go towards the higher frequencies, as you get past 5 and 6 kilohertz, your ability to resolve the frequencies is not as good as it is down at towards the low end. KTRW,
K2J. Coming.
I think almost everything about a human being is logarithmic. So frequency resolution probably goes logarithmic. Sensitivity of both eye and hearing, and maybe even taste and touch, are also logarithmic. The higher frequency, shorter cilia are near the tight end of the cochlea. I am guessing that when loud sounds that the standing waves set up gives you a kind of energy concentration by the crashing waves on the shore, so to speak, energy concentration is occurring on the more delicate, short cilia near the end of that tightly wrapped situation. And is that the reason why it's easier to explain the high frequency sensitivity loss of a person who is exposed to loud sounds? You can tell I'm making a bunch of guesses here, Eric. Over here, Eric, KQLAW.
Your logic is perfectly sound. If you go by fluid dynamics, you know, as you decrease the diameter of the vessel, and especially low frequency sounds, which actually move the oval window a huge distance because they're loud, because you don't get loud high frequency to the extent of how much motion you create. So the amount of pressure that's created is amplified as it goes down to the smaller and smaller diameter to the point where it has to get absorbed. Yeah, that's why you lose the high end before anything else. And you don't need to be hearing high frequencies for that to happen. You just need a lot of sound pressure.
I'm beginning to catch on. Sounds like you may have also done some study of human hearing, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Actually, this is about the sound propagation. But anyhow, I can recall the time when the Walkman were introduced and plenty of young people were listening to loud music through the headphones. One of the things that is interesting there is that there is a problem with headphones carrying on low frequencies. So even if you have a very high quality headphones, they may not be as good in it. But talking about the absorption, I have a graph in front of me, which is a sound absorption coefficient per atmosphere for air at 20 degrees, because the original question was about the ships. And that is according to relative humidity per atmosphere. And what it looks like, the low sounds are of absolutely zero attenuation. But right after you go over 2 kilohertz, then you have respectively 10, 20, 40, 60, and 80 dBs of attenuation when you go higher and higher. That's why most of the people, instead of being able to hear 20 kilohertz, they hear 16 kilohertz at most. But anyhow, interesting is that it's kind of convoluted. The high-frequency sounds are easily reflected. So you might say when the ship is using a low-frequency horn or high-frequency horn, there should be no difference. But the low-frequency are absorbed to the structure, then created part of this energy resonates with the structure and then create additional amplification. However, waves are constructed this way, the material, so it's based on the material. Waves, with their very much characteristic shape, if you remember end of 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, those big tubes for the gramophones, they react very much simply the same way, so you might actually have a low-frequency sound that is traveling and is being amplified instead of being attenuated. That's kind of strange. And to actually,
I don't quite follow what Wesley's saying. Maybe I just don't understand him.
Okay, yeah. Why don't you pose a question on what you just heard, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, I have the problem with listening to Wesley. My ears don't work that well. You know, what I'm really asking you to do is tell me what he said.
The guy who is more expert at that than I is John, because John has talked to Wesley for 4 times as many hours as I ever have. As such, I think John has become an extremely good interpreter. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, usually you'd be right, Dick, but I'm confused. He vacillated so much, I don't know what he was trying to say. So maybe if he could just repeat the meaning of his, the explanation he was trying to give, and then I'll rebroadcast it to Eric. Wesley, you want to try it again?
Okay. Well, I started with headphones not being able to produce a low-frequency sound. That's what I started with. And then I started with the sound travel. Whether it sound travel from headphones that have low sensitivities to the low sound, we may say because of the aperture. The headphone is very small, so the aperture, the area that is vibrating in a headphone and producing the loud phone is insufficient to be able to resonate. Then I went to another thing, which is a sound reflection. When we talk about a sound reflection, high frequencies are easier reflected from walls or other structures. So we may say, okay, if the sound is reflected, the sound is not being lost, it's just reflected. So we should be able to hear the high frequency tones as well as the low frequency tones. Interrupt me when you have a problem. I remember when I was working in geophysics, we were actually reading a sound that was coming from the ground. And the deeper the sound came from, that was the lower frequency of it. So then I was trying to reach that material that was available and create my own opinion on it. What it looks like is that sound, when it's traveling, is creating a resonating areas with the upper layers of the ground. But at the same time, when the low sound is being absorbed partially by the walls, it's creating a resonation on the big area. That is very much similar to the tube that you had with the old gramophones that was actually a mechanical amplification of the sound that came from the needle that was on the ground, a gramophone disc.
That's too much information at once. John, do you remember any of it?
KC2WGB. Well, Eric, he was demonstrating the fact that with the Sony Walkmans, which is what he was talking about, the area of the headphones was much too small to produce the low frequencies. I think you'll agree with that. And he was saying that, you know, hearing damage from those things, they were playing them very loud, but they really couldn't produce the low frequencies. The other thing he was saying before he started to interpret what he was saying before was about foghorns, that the extreme low frequency of foghorns is traveling, hitting structures, and causing them to resonate, and therefore amplifying the low frequency sound, and that's why they use that low frequency, because it seems to be carried more efficiently in the air. Those are two of the representations out of that whole dissertation that I can explain so far. So, Wesley, anything to correct, or is that right?
Then the next thing, the reflection coefficient is dependent on the material. So if you have a hard structure, most likely you have a better resonating factor, but also better ability that sound to be amplified and partially reflected to another structure. However, waves, based on their own shape, the curvature of the shape, in some instances create amplification instead of attenuation. Although, it sounds like we're not conserving energy in here, but it is just a matter of the regional concentration of all of the amplification. That's why when you're on the sea or you're in the ocean, you're dealing with different kinds of reflection. One of the reflections is the closest waves bounce back the sound to the body of the ship, and because the body of the ship is large, now the body of the ship by itself acts as an additional resonator and resonates it out. When I was doing with the geophysics, we were actually having a passive piezoelectric foil that was placed on the ground, and it was the subject of the patent that we've got a patent for it. And it was assigned to my company. The sounds, the sounds from the ground could be made by many factors. Could be a volcanic eruption, could be a vibration, man-caused factors, or could be just because of the rotation of the Earth or rotation inside the Earth. Now, those sounds produce travel up. The lower the sound, the deeper it comes from as a beginning of. And that's why we're able to determine the presence of the given layer from the surface. And that's why we had a scientist from geophysics, USGS, present all the time with us. And I was at that time a principal investigator that was assigned to that project. Anyhow, that's about the sound. So, as strange as it sounds,
hold on. Like Eric said, too much information. One topic at a time. I think Eric will agree. High frequencies are very directional. Low frequencies, not so much. But you claim that the waves can amplify that low frequency. I don't know if Eric and Dick would agree with that, so let's take a break here and see if that floats or not. Dick, over to you, sir.
So, I am guessing that when it comes to geophysical measurements, geophone measurements, because you get various densities of various portions of the material below the surface of the Earth, you get local scattering centers. The sounds that will travel through the Earth efficiently are the very low-frequency, large wavelengths, because those large wavelengths will look at these concentration areas as a minor perturbation. The higher frequency notes hitting those mass concentration areas are going to create random scattering. You don't have a coherent wavefront anymore. That's a guess on my part as to why low-frequency notes through the Earth propagate better, longer. It may also be related to why elephants are able to communicate with each other at very low frequency notes over many miles. And is that communication going through the ground or through the air? I'm not sure, but I know that elephants can communicate with each other at very low frequency notes over a very large number of miles. Is that about what you heard, John? KC2WGB, KQRIW?
What you said makes sense. What do you think of amplification of low frequency by wave structure of the ocean? I don't think so. Let's hear what Eric has to say, too. Back to you, Dick.
It's not amplification. It's conservation of energy. When an ocean wave looks fairly mild, you know, 1 meter high, half meter high, out in the middle of the ocean, as it approaches the shore, and the shore is now becoming more and more shallow, and the exact same amount of energy of that wave is being confined to a smaller and smaller space, vertically speaking. Now you get a larger-looking wave that breaks. I guess one person could call that amplification. Amplification of the size of the wave that you see. There's no real amplification going on there. There's still conservation of energy.
the energy of that wave far out in the ocean had a lot more depth to it than was obvious when you look at the surface. And when all of that energy of that various depths gets concentrated near the shore, you can call it amplification, but it really isn't. Amplification of vertical magnitude, yes. Amplification of total energy, I say no. Let's see if Erica, who brought up the waves of the ocean earlier, let's see if he agrees with that. KE2EJ, K2LRW.
Can I add something, Dad? I don't know if you recall you were in a big hall, or you sometimes were in an open area and you wanted to listen to the music or sound, and then you've noticed that you're standing in one point when it's very far away and you can hear better than the people closer to it. So it's local phenomena. It's not wide phenomena. The amplification is actually conservation of the sound in the given areas. You may find the spots 2, 3, 5, 10 miles away, and you can have a perfect ability to hear that sound very, very loud. As somewhere in the middle is always not heard. Back to Dick.
Can't you wait your turn, Westwood? Come on, you know?
In the case of our youth using earbuds, earphones, or just playing hi-fi music in their house, a significant percentage of our youth just can't make it loud enough. And the bottom line of that is now you go to a wedding reception, and that DJ is playing music that is really, from my point of view, 20 decibels too loud. I always make sure that the table I'm sitting at is as far away from the DJ as you can get. I'm very disappointed by the fact that at this wedding, I'm seeing relatives that are distant, that I only see once every 5 years. Here they are in one place at one time. I'd like to talk to them. They're directly across the table to me, and without using hand signals, they cannot hear me. I don't know why in the world people will tolerate that. They want the music so loud that when they're dancing, they can feel the floor vibrating.
I got the answer for you, Dick.
And what that's doing to their hearing is just out of sight, the amount of damage that's creating. What do you think is the answer to all this, John? Go ahead.
BC2WGB. Well, Dick, in the press rooms and in industry, hearing loss is drastic. It happens a lot. They make these very soft, sponge-like materials that are shaped in sort of like a little condom that you put into your ears, and they have a lace that goes behind your neck, but you can clip that off. Next time you go to one of those meetings or a place where you're going to have loud music, grab a pair of those and try them. You can still hear the conversation, but boy, does it attenuate the music. I'm sure Eric is familiar with how they work. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, run this by again. If I bought the usual foam earplugs, why is this thing that you're describing different? And by the way, I have gone to weddings where I have worn earplugs. Over to you, John.
Okay, well, basically you've got the idea then. I thought maybe you've never used them. They are very comfortable. They take the shape of the canal of the ear, and nobody knows you have them on if you clip the necklace off, because when you're in the press room, you have to pull out the earplugs so when you are doing something else, and they just hang around your neck. But those are ideal for that situation, and you can still hear conversation. Back to you.
Eric, when you're at a wedding, Eric, do you have trouble hearing the person having a conversation with the person who's across the table from you, even if you're at the far end of the room compared to the DJ, KE2EJ, K2RAW?
Oh, my reality is I have trouble hearing somebody in a quiet room. Well, that's why I always make sure I can see them for the reason. And that kind of works out. But I still protect my ears, you know. I don't want to damage what hearing I do have, so. My favorite thing is I'll go up to the DJ and tell him, I pull out my cell phone, which has a sound pressure meter in it, and show him that you're hurting these people, and they'll turn it down.
When you make that measurement of sound pressure with your cell phone, I presume there is a recommended maximum, I'm going to pick a number, 100 dB relative, I guess it's called, 110, some number like that. you have found DJs that are how many decibels above recommended maximum so that you don't create hearing damage? Over to you, Eric, KQLAW.
Anything that's over about 105 dB of sound pressure is where damage begins. Okay, you expose yourself to 120 dB of sound pressure, you're really asking for a lot of trouble later in life. You won't notice it right then and there, but if you actually do walk out of the room and you were to take a hearing test, you'll find that the dynamic range of your hearing all of a sudden got compressed. It's actually disorienting if you're trying to do location by sound. And it takes a little while, and it comes back, but you know, up in front of the speakers, if it's 100 dB, then it's usually okay at the back of the room, you know, reasonable. But still, it's loud.
You've made measurements, Eric. What's the highest measurement you've ever experienced at a wedding-like reception? Go ahead.
Oh, well, a wedding-like reception, I've seen them go as high as 130. I've seen people bring in, you know, ridiculous amplifiers. I mean, the studio I just put together in New Jersey, each one of our speakers has got a 1,500-watt amplifier behind it. I can raise the sound pressure in that room to, like, 130, 135. Usually, it'll still go more, but what I've done was I put limiting amplifiers on it so that they can't make it too loud.
But you have measured numbers like 120 at a wedding, and the DJ thought that that was perfectly all right until you told him?
No, those numbers never came from a DJ. They came from a band.
So you've seen bands, a live band, making 120. Wow. Which I presume is, in theory, damaging the hearing of the people on the nearest tables. Is that true?
And who was over that, right, Eric?
The band members, you know, look at the stuff that they have in their ears. You know that they're conscious, but they're only being conscious of themselves.
Wow. What'd you say, John?
I'm sure Eric has heard the Who play. They played a few times in the Garden, and they were over 120. That's for sure.
Oh, I've seen them. I've been on the stage with them, actually. I've had, for many years back, I had a very close connection to it. I've seen them in Madison Square Garden raise 160 easily.
I think you said 160, and I presume you mean a couple of feet in front of one of their loudspeakers. The nearest person in that audience was getting roughly what number, do you think, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, with 160 coming out of the contraption of speakers, right, I think it was about, what was it, 2 feet. But that's suspended, and when it finally rains down on everybody, you know they're getting hit with 120, 130.
Is there a, what's the word I'm looking for now, OSHA, NIOSH, is there a standard along these lines that's already published, is the standards of being violated? Is OSHA and NIOSH just asleep at the wheel here? What's going on here, Eric, as far as legality? KQLIW?
OSHA specifies sound pressure levels in many different environments. Now, as far as I know, they don't specify what it can be in the entertainment area. SMPTE specifies what the maximum loudness should be in a motion picture theater. Let's put it this way. For many years, the FOH at the front of the house is operated by an individual that pretty much sits at the console and adjusts it to his liking.
So I think you're saying SMPTE recommends don't go above 105 in a theater. Depending on what particular movie is being projected, do a large percentage of the theaters on the loud scene of the movie go to 105 dB? Over to you, Eric.
You'll typically find it in action pictures where in the movie theater doing 7.1 and two channels of subwoofer channels. So, you know, they want to make the seat shake. So it takes a bit of sound pressure, but it's really low frequency. But, yeah, the actual playback equipment that's in movie theaters is really sophisticated, you know, today. I mean, you go back a whole bunch of years, it was just an Altec amplifier. Nowadays, it's a an entire Dolby of DBX thing that's got the volume limiting, specific programming for the characteristics of the room that it's playing in.
Many of the SEMTI regulated movie theaters, the acoustic equipment that's there, give me a rough guess as to the frequency region. Will it go down as low as 20 hertz? Does it go as high as 16 kilohertz? Over to you, Eric.
You know, it's broken up, actually. The subwoofer stuff will run from, what is it, 4 hertz, I think it is, because there's jiggers. Then there's a little notch, I think around 10 hertz, and then it starts at something like 12 hertz, and that's an air mover. That runs to like 30 hertz, and then it's the traditional audio stuff, but because it's broken up into multi-channel, I think the, there's one reason, depends on who designed the theater, whose it is, but some of them will be, have a specific bank of subwoofers, or rather woofers that cover from like 30 hertz to 200 hertz, and then there'll be a crossover, there'll be some mid-ranges that'll run from 500 to 2.5K, and there might be some piezos that take care of the high end, depending on the layout, and, you know, there'll be speakers overhead and speakers to the left and right of you, so there's a whole variety of things that go on, and SEMTI doesn't regulate anything, they only recommend that these are standard.
Well-equipped movie theater, what's the high end, Eric? Do they go as high as 10 or 15 kilohertz?
IMAX series that were put together by IMAX and not some other company, they'll go to 20 kilohertz.
Wow, 20 kilohertz. And they're doing that because they feel that a certain percentage of the audience either really hears that or somehow is sensing it, and somehow it increases the liveliness of the presentation. Go ahead.
No, I think that's just incidental. With the piezos start to roll off at 22. The amplifiers that they've used go up that high. But there's no reason to go that high. Most people can't hear there. Unless you want to make the dogs bark. But I think that's just incidental. When they sweep it, that's what it comes out to be. But, you know, if you don't put any energy there, nothing comes out.
A crossover network really is a low-pass, band-pass, and high-pass filter-like structure. All filters, as you approach the roll-off frequency of the filter, start going into a very rapid phase shift. Therefore, the crossover network firing a loudspeaker is created individual frequencies and phase shifts.
Yeah, but you use active crossovers, which are actually long-chains and op-amps. They've got pretty good skirts.
Okay, so you're telling me that these well-designed crossover networks firing well-designed audio systems are not creating phony suckouts. I think you're telling me they're not creating phony phase shifts across that frequency region. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, if you look at some high-end installations, it really snaps the room. Which covers small bands of frequency where the crossover is on. So it's sophisticated. There's a lot of people about it. And then,
figure out what's going on. Why don't you repeat a little bit of that, Eric, while I watch the screen.
Yeah, okay. Is that the amount of energy that when it's and it's pretty much done exclusively. So, you know, an IR filter in some cases, or a FIR filter in others,
that you can between the band. It's sort of like when you're thinking this world is putting a little order between the two of them to make the right decision. And that because they went through such an effort, not only in terms of the electronics, but also the physical layout of the room, absorbers and reflectors and directors, which are placed in the room. If you want to go with something interesting like that, just go to Lincoln Center. Go to the Opera House and watch the panels actually move as they change the set.
I can see a lot of real good design goes into the audio systems of these good theaters. We've got roughly 1 minute left. This was TechNet number 1,564 of the series, with a space report number 157 of the series. We'll discover a few more of these messages that Mother Nature is trying to give us, and we're still slowly starting to hear the message. I'm still amazed at what I've been saying on the tech debt for so darn many years with reference to wide conductor resonators for radios, wide conductor radiators for antennas, what the advantage is. And because the people who design antennas are so stuck in the paradigm, in other words, antenna designers, let me drop.
Hey, Dick, by the way, I wanted to say one real quick thing.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, going back to Wesley, sound has an interesting property, is that it can hit your eye at a moving medium. So what he might call as amplification is, you know, the conservation of energy says, no, nothing amplifies it. You have to give it energy in order for that to happen. So the transfer of energy from something moving, like moving air, you know, as the wind blows, you hear the train whistle from a far away. When the wind's not blowing, you don't hear nothing. Stuff like that. So a lot of things of what he says is not quite true today. We have earbuds that produce 20 hertz, no problem. It's an interesting technique that they do to produce that. But, you know, that's all. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, next week I'd like you to give us a few words as to what they've done to the design of earplugs to go down to such low frequencies. The good news is that it's a very closed channel between it and the eardrum, and therefore for it to launch low-frequency notes is a...
Imagine that most of the manufacturers today of iPods and that stuff limit the output. You can't make them do that.
Oh. Okay. Bye-bye, you all. Try to be kind to each other. John, I'm going to pass it over to you to put the ribbons on, tie the ribbons on. KC2WGB, thank you, and good luck with the work on the mailbag and the Echo Link K2RW. You got it, John.
Very good, Dick. Everybody have a great night and a beautiful week. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us, and we look forward to hearing from you again next week. Always a pleasure. This is KC2. WGB. Say goodnight.
K2RW. Good night, gang. Have a good evening. K2UPS.
Okay, I heard both Rich, UPS, and I think, was Roy the other guy? Who was the other guy besides Rich?
Rich, WB2GXM.
That's the GXM. Okay, GXM first. Go ahead.
Rich, Dick, sorry. What is the call of the guy with the Alpha Delta antenna? I have information for him.
Are you talking about a fan dipole? We see the Alpha Delta antenna. What kind of antenna are we talking about?
During the TechNet, he was talking about Balin's for his Alpha Delta fan dipole.
That was Steve, KD2HUC, Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Uniform Charlie.
Thank you very much, Dick. I'm going to send him information on the DX Engineering. Hotel Uniform Charlie. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Here we go. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, who's probably approaching Pennsylvania. K2RAW. Go ahead, Rich.
How you doing, Dick? Now I'm well into Pennsylvania. I'm past Breezewood, heading for Flystown. That's where my shift will end around 2 o'clock. But that was a good man, very entertaining, and I sent you an email, at least a month or so ago. It was a photograph of a bumper sticker. It was a red bumper sticker. And I said, if this sticker looks blue, you're going too fast. Do you remember getting that?
Yes, I do. Good stuff. And glad you enjoy. And by the way, the real good people in the world, the people who accomplish something, are called the movers and shakers. Hey, Rich, you are always moving. And while you're moving, you're probably shaking. Oh, you, Rich.
It is probably true. I have trouble sleeping at home because the bed doesn't shake. So, have a good evening, Dick. We'll catch you later on. KTUPS Mobile, Pennsylvania.
You're a guy that collects the same kind of information as I do sometimes. There was an article in QST Magazine, about 10 or so years ago. I think the thing was on the front cover. It was a mobile antenna, and I would call it a Texas Longhorn antenna. In other words, it had a pair of, let me call them quarter-wave long ground plane-like radiators, but the two ground plane radiators were essentially parallel to the roof of something like a recreation vehicle. So, to some degree, it was a dipole with a 60-degree apex angle, a V dipole. And I think it was called Texas Longhorn. No matter how I look at the archives, can't find that darn article. There is something called the Connecticut Longhorn, which is very different. I wonder if you happen to remember that article, Rich. K2UPS, K2RIW.
I don't remember that at all. I don't remember anything about it, like a Longhorn antenna. I remember you discussing it, and at first I thought you were talking about the Texas bug catcher, but that's different. That's like a capacitive hat on a screwdriver. But I'm not familiar with that one at all, no. Back then, 10 years ago, I probably wasn't getting QST at the time, so I couldn't even go back and look it up myself.
Okay, I thank you. Maybe I just dreamed it. There's a buddy I know who I think would be helpful. He would be helped. He's about to put a good mobile antenna onto his Cherokee, I think it is. And if that antenna, if I could find the article, it would be a good candidate for him to consider. But then once again, as long as the antenna is as close to balanced as you can get, and it resonates, it's going to do the job. And so a pure vertical antenna is the most logical thing for a vehicle, but now the counterpoise becomes a little bit spooky. Is the vehicle big enough? Does it have enough capacitance to earth that it's not launching a whole lot of signal into the ground? Some kind of an antenna that can be thoroughly balanced, like a V dipole that all squeezes onto the roof of a vehicle, I somehow feel has the capability of being at higher in total radiated power without heating up the local earth. That's a belief of mine. So I'm still looking for that article. Back to you for any final, Rich. And thanks for joining us. KTUPS Mobile in Western PA, K2RIW.
Okay, well, the only thing I can offer is that I'm going to be in Newington this Friday, July 17th. I'm going up with a couple of people to visit the station, check out the museum and stuff up there. So, which, by the way, if you're interested in going, you're more than welcome to join us. Just up and back, go up, have lunch up there, and operate and come back home again. Maybe by dinner time there, about depending on traffic. But I can ask them there in person about that article and see if I can glean any information for you.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that, Rich. And it's worth a try. The archive search engine connected to the ARRL site, I know could be improved. There are times when I give it all the information about my own article, where I know the name of the author, the call letters of the author, the month and year it was published, and there are times when that archive search engine will say that article doesn't exist. And so the fact that the archive, I've made multiple attempts at the archive search engine, it can't find it. Maybe they remember it. Okay, I thank you, and see you down the log. Bye-bye for now, Rich. K2LAW clear.
7-3, KTUPS.
K2RWWH1YY. Have you ever thought of contacting the administrator of the website that has the information you're looking for and maybe bringing the problem to their attention? Maybe they're unaware of something that might be wrong with the filing system or how it's filed.
Yeah, I guess that's a possibility, Rich. And that archive search engine for the ARRL, I guess up till now I've always assumed that that was something written by for a subcontractor for ARRL. I guess by some means there's a method of